All right, let's kick things off by talking about how electrons actually fill up atomic orbitals. You know, this is all about the Aufbau principle, which literally translates to building up. The idea is electrons are added one at a time to the lowest energy orbital available, then you build up to higher ones as you go along. So for helium, you get both electrons in that 1s orbital, nice and snug. But once you get to lithium, well, there is no more room in 1s, so the third electron ends up to the 2s, and then it just keeps going from there.
Yeah, and one of the key reasons for this order is that s orbitals actually penetrate closer to the nucleus than, say, p or d orbitals. And that's huge, because only the s orbitals have electron density right at the nucleus. P and d orbitals, they've got some nodes, so they never get as close. That means there's less shielding for s electrons. They feel the nuclear charge more directly, and as a result, they're bound tighter to the atom. So when we look at effective nuclear charge, an s orbital in a given principal energy level is lower in energy than a p orbital with the same energy level, which in turn is lower in energy than a d orbital, also in that same n level. So the electrons in the s orbital feel the most pull from the nucleus, something we will refer to as Z effective.
Exactly, and I just want to stress, this is all about energy. The energy difference between a 2s and a 2p electron comes down to things like shielding and penetration, not just which orbital is next alphabetically. That's why even further down the periodic table, we see what feels like abnormalities, like the 4s filling before 3d. When you get into the transition metals, then things really switch up. The finer details get complicated, but qualitatively, the Aufbau principle really helps us make sense of the overall structure. And the periodic table itself, the way those blocks are arranged, that's basically Aufbau in action.
These ideas about shielding and penetration set us up perfectly to talk about what controls how many electrons go into each orbital. So let's dive into what keeps electrons from piling up all in one place, the Pauli exclusion principle.
All right, so Pauli exclusion, this is one of those rules that is incredibly simple but absolutely fundamental. Basically, no two electrons in the same atom can have exactly the same four quantum numbers. If two electrons occupy the same orbital, meaning they have the same N, L, and M sub L, they must have opposite spins, which is why you'll hear each orbital can hold a maximum of two electrons, and they have to be spin paired.
And this is where Hund's rule jumps in and plays a supporting role. Hund's rule says, for orbitals with the same energy, like the 3p orbitals or the 5d orbitals, electrons prefer to spread out, one per orbital, with parallel spins before any doubling up happens. I always picture it like students finding empty seats on a bus. First, they all want their own seat before anyone has to double up. Not a perfect analogy, but you get the idea.
No, I like it. And you can see this in real chemistry, right? Take carbon, for example, element 6. Its electron configuration is 1s2, 2s2, 2p2. Those 2p electrons don't go into the same p orbital. They spread into two different ones, both with parallel spins, so both up or both down. That minimizes electron-electron repulsion and keeps the atom at a lower energy. And we can actually detect this. If an atom has unpaired electrons, it's paramagnetic. If all electrons are paired, it's diamagnetic.
Well, now you are speaking my language. This is the most fundamental idea that my research is based off of. I study copper centers, specifically copper 2, as it is paramagnetic. The instrument I use is electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, or EPR for short. I am able to see anything that is paramagnetic, but nothing that is diamagnetic, like copper 1. So, I can differentiate between the types of copper and understand what complexes are forming or reactions are happening.
Yeah, we use a little EPR in my lab as well. It is a pretty cool instrument. Definitely not talked about as much as others in chemistry, but quite powerful nonetheless. Anyway, let's get back to the topic. Now, working through electron configurations.
And you can see how those rules really connect to the bigger picture on the periodic table. The way S, P, D, and F blocks get filled. The shapes of those blocks, Pauli and Hund govern all that. It might seem repetitive, but those two principles explain so much about atomic structure, including things like chemical magnetism, reactivity, and sometimes even color in transition compounds.
All right, so we've got how electrons fill up and why they don't just keep stacking up in the lowest orbital. But now comes maybe the trickiest part for a lot of students, the idea of effective nuclear charge and how we actually quantify all that electron shielding.
Yeah, I think this is where things can get just a bit intimidating, but it's super satisfying when it clicks. Effective nuclear charge, or ZEFF, is really the net positive charge and electron fields from the nucleus, after you account for all those other electrons that are pushing back, or shielding. And as we've been hinting, not all electrons shield equally. That's exactly where Slater's rules come in.
So Slater's rules give us a kind of recipe for figuring out the shielding constant, S, which is how much of the nuclear charge gets blocked out. The process is pretty step by step. First, you break the electron configuration into groups, like 1s, then 2s, and 2p, then 3s, and 3p, and so on. Next, you pick out the electron you want to look at and ignore any electrons in higher groups. Those aren't shielding because they are further away from the nucleus, not inside blocking that electron's path. Then, you add up contributions from those that are on the inside. Electrons in the same group each count as 0.35 for S and P electrons, except 1s, which is 0.3. Electrons in the next lower group, N-1, count as 0.85, and anything even further in counts as a full 1.0. D and F electron rules are a little different, but the idea is the same.
Let's try a worked example, because honestly, it helps so much. Take nitrogen with its electron configuration 1, 1, S2, 2, S2, 2, P3. If we're figuring out the shielding constant for a 2P electron, the two 1S electrons each count as 0.85, and the four remaining electrons in the 2S and 2P count as 0.35 each. So S for 2P in nitrogen is 0.85 times 2 plus 0.35 times 4, which gives us a total shielding of 3.10.
Yeah, and if we jump to something heavier, like bromine, a 4p electron, there are a lot more groups, but the procedure is the same. You total up the contributions from each group according to Slater's chart. For bromine 4p, you end up with S equal to 28.9 if you follow that method.
And that all feeds right back into effective nuclear charge. The formula is pretty simple. Z effective equals the actual nuclear charge Z, also counted as the atomic number, minus your shielding constant S. So, like in boron, if the nuclear charge is 5 and your S is about 2.4, Z effective is 2.6. It looks basic, but the periodic trends that come out of this. For example, why ionization energy increases across a period, or why atomic size decreases, all are explained by increasing Z effective as you go left to right.
And what's cool is, even though there are more complex models out there, like the Hartree-Fock methods, which you might run into in more advanced classes, Slater's rules are pretty remarkable for their simplicity and reasonable accuracy. They explain why, as we fill in different orbitals across the table, the chemistry of elements follows those tidy patterns.
I really like that we can move from the qualitative, those more or less ideas about shielding and penetration, to something we can actually calculate with numbers. It's empowering, and it clears up a lot of the mystery behind periodic trends. Anyway, we'll keep returning to these themes, because understanding effective nuclear charge is, honestly, the foundation for a ton of new topics we're going to explore.
Absolutely. So that wraps up today's deep dive. If you're trying out these calculations and run into a snag, don't worry. We'll work through more examples as we go. Morgan, thanks for another great session, and thank you everyone for listening.
Thanks, Ben. Always fun to break down the rules behind the periodic table. We'll see everyone next time for more chemistry. You don't want to miss it. Bye, Ben.